This is Barry Tyker of the University of Wisconsin Archives Oral History Project. Today is February 2nd, the year 2001. Groundhog Day, by the way.
Right.
They saw their shadow, so I guess that's bad news for us. Isn't that how it goes?
Bad news or good news?
See, I always get that mixed up, too.
I did, too. I thought it meant we'd have 6 more weeks of winter.
That's bad news, isn't it?
Not for Wisconsin. We're going to have 6 or more.
Marcia Lee is, I'm continuing an interview we began late last year, and we're going to be talking about her involvement in the Chancellor's Scholarship Program for undergraduate and disadvantaged students. Darcy Colleen, my project assistant, is also sitting in on this interview. I just gave you the name of the program as it exists today. Marcia, perhaps you could begin by telling us how the program was named.
Okay. We spent some time after getting approval from Irv Shane, our chancellor, and the vice chancellor, Brian Curl, thinking about what name we would use for the scholarship. And actually, I talked to a number of people. Roger Howard was the one that I talked with most specifically about this, and bounced some ideas off him and said what we'd really like to do. At that time, we already had the Dean's Scholarship in the College of Letters and Science, and so I was saying, well, we couldn't use Dean's because that already existed. This was a campus-wide program, and so we needed something at another level. And as I recall, Roger said something to me about, well, what would you like to call it? And I said, well, I'd like it to be the Chancellor's Scholarship Program, or something like that. And so he, as usual, said, well, why don't you try it? You know, go for it. And he said, I'm sure that there will be some difficulty with it, but, you know, let's just see what happens. And so I talked then with Brad Curl and told him that that was the title that I'd like to use. And he said, well, others are using this title, and so you'll have to negotiate with them in order to get it. And he said, start with Wally Dalma, because they have some scholarships in the financial aid office that carry the title Chancellors. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, we certainly would want to have a title that's confusing, but I think this is the best title for this program. So he said, okay, go talk to him. And I did. And after, I think, Wally's initial surprise that I was saying that we wanted now to use the Chancellor's title for this program, because essentially we knew that that would communicate broadly to any prospective donor that this scholarship had the full approval of our top administrators. And so we wouldn't have to spend a lot of time answering the question as to whether or not the chancellor was supportive or was the second in command supportive. The title itself would communicate that. We also wanted to make it to have a title that would indicate that this was both a very selective and prestigious award, and that too would make it attractive to prospective students. When you say that you are being offered a scholarship that carries the title of the highest officer at the university, then that makes a difference to people. And many of our counterparts that had established similar scholarships also had called them the presidential scholars or something of that nature. So I knew we should be in that category. And so after a while, Wally was in agreement, and we first started calling the program the Chancellor's Achievement Scholarship for minority and disadvantaged students. And it was only a short time before I realized that I didn't like the title achievement, or the word achievement in the title, and wanted to drop it and just simply said to people around campus that it's going to be Chancellor's Scholarship for Minority and Disadvantaged Students. And so that's been the name ever since.
And so that was very early, right before as the program was forming.
Yes.
So it's really been known only by that name campus-wide.
I think the only place Achievement appears is probably at the UW Foundation, because we very quickly shifted to the title that we're using today.
Now, last time we ended, you talked about a little bit about the involvement of the alumni in the program, the involvement of the faculty. We talked about the hiring of Marion Brown, and the fact, of course, the fact that Bri Curl and Irv Shane had both written off on the program, in favor of the program, and Irv had made a nice contribution to kind of kick things off. I know this is a while ago, this is about 16 years ago, and you've had many, many classes since, but can you recall, how much can you recall about that initial, the recruitment of the students and those, they're bringing them to college, to campus for the first time, and any and contact with parents and any kind of orientation programs that you might have had?
I suspect that we did in that first year some of the things that we've continued to do since. And that is, we work very closely with the staff that has the responsibility to recruit minority students in the Office of Admissions. And we probably also began mailing letters to directors of guidance or counseling at selected high schools throughout the state and other places where we've drawn students. And we would send them a brochure and just a brief letter asking them to identify their top students and encourage them to apply. So we've continued that practice until the current time. Now we're mailing to over 500 on an annual basis and encouraging them to identify students. And the staff in the admissions office have always talked to really bright and talented students about the program. Once we announced it, alumni and friends certainly started referring students to us or telling them about the scholarship. And I think one of the very important things that we were able to accomplish with Marion beginning with the program is that she helped to develop contact lists for minority alums and other alums that would be supportive of the program, and really helped to update the records here at the university of our alumni. And so very early on, our alumni were on board, very supportive of the program. And I'm not sure I've talked about the role that a faculty committee played in this program.
You just mentioned them very briefly, more or less in passing, that one had been formed, but you didn't.
Well, for a number of years, dating back to the 70s, there has been a standing faculty senate committee on the academic affairs of minority and disadvantaged students. And that committee has made recommendations for I'm going to say forever, but ever since that time, for many of the programs and activities that we have on campus that both attract and support these populations. And so I was staff to that committee at that time. And so once I had approval from the chancellor to move ahead with it, we made the presentation to that committee and got their full support. And we had a letter that went out, I think, under the name of that committee, although I'm not entirely sure of that, but at any rate, I think that's what that was. And it was a letter written to all faculty on campus informing them of the establishment of the scholarship and requesting their support. Very early, Bryce said to me, now before you can go out to do any fundraising, you need to have an opportunity for people on campus to contribute, because prospective donors will always want to know what's the level of commitment that you have at the university. So we had already solicited contributions from the faculty before we contacted any potential donor. And so we had a number of faculty members then who started supporting the scholarship that first year, and they have continued to this day. There are several who have made their memberships to the Bascom Hill Society through a gift to this program. So our faculty have continued to be very significant supporters of this program, in addition to serving as mentors for the scholars throughout their undergraduate careers.
Now that you just started to answer my next question, which was the faculty mentoring program, was that something that you started right away, and what did a mentor do, essentially?
Well, I know you had asked me earlier about how we selected the students, and perhaps I should say that, and then I can move into this. And if I forget it, remind me.
Okay.
We developed the program with the eligibility criteria that has been included in the brochures and all of our literature since that time. So we look for students who have strong academic records, a GPA of 3.0 or above, strong test scores, high rank in class, and participation in co-curricular activities in their schools and communities. And these students then have to submit an essay on a question that's included in the brochure, three letters of reference, and their transcripts. And that information is reviewed by a faculty staff committee. We do this on an annual basis, and each member of that committee reviews every scholarship application that we receive, and then we make the selections. Typically, a Chancellor Scholar has well above a 3.0 GPA. They rank within the 90th percentile of their graduating class. They have strong ACT or SAT scores, and they have been just incredibly involved and activities in their schools and communities, providing leadership, volunteering, etc. So we bring in then some of the brightest and most talented students that you can find any place. And it's always been a challenge since the first year of the program to select the number that we could support, because since this is a privately supported program, we had to start out bringing in only the number of scholars that we could support through our fundraising efforts. So that's how we began with six. And in that first class, we wanted to make sure that we had people from each of the underrepresented groups. So that would have been four at least. And we wanted certainly to have a good balance, if you think of balance within six, of gender. And we've always known that we would have more from Wisconsin than any place else. But we also wanted geographic diversity in the program, as well as racial and ethnic diversity in gender. And so in that first class, I'll have to think of their names before I can tell you basically where they came from. But we had one that came from Colorado, one from Minnesota, one from Washington, D.C., and then the other three were from Wisconsin. And their majors were varied. And of course, as we were thinking about what we could do for these students when they came to the university, we knew from the very beginning that we wanted to do more in the way of supporting and encouraging them than would normally happen with most scholarship programs. In other words, we didn't want to just hand them a check and forget about them. Because in a large, complex university like this, where there were so few people who looked like them, that they could feel comfortable interacting with, contacting when they had problems or concerns, that the program itself needed to provide that kind of support that would be so essential to them. And so we started thinking through what kinds of components we wanted in the program. And initially, it included a faculty staff mentor for each of the scholars. And this did not carry the typical connotation of the mentoring relationship, but rather we were looking for faculty members who enjoyed interacting with undergraduates, who knew the resources of the university, and who would be willing to give their time to establish friendships with these young people. I thought initially of having them paired with faculty in their major areas, and for the first year decided to go with people who are faculty members who were not in their major areas, and wanted to think it through a bit more. And in the course of that first year, I discussed this issue with our first class, and it was really interesting that without question, they agreed with my thinking that it would be best not to have them paired with people in their major areas. Now, we had different reasons for it, but we were in agreement. And my concern was I didn't want them having a relationship with a faculty member in their major area, because we would again be tilting more toward the authoritarian kind of relationship and shifting from the friendship aspect of this that we wanted. And I also knew that for undergraduates, it's often difficult for them to make a decision about changing their major because they know a faculty member or a staff member whom they think may be disappointed that they're not continuing in those areas. And so just decided then, okay, we will go with people in different disciplines so that they're also being exposed to people who are thinking about some of the critical issues from different perspectives. So we wanted to have then an interdisciplinary kind of experience for these young people. So they would certainly meet the faculty in their major areas with faculty with whom they took courses, but we would introduce them in this program to other faculty that they might not otherwise come in contact with. And the same was true for administrators as well. And I think one of my other real coups was to talk to Brad Curl about his serving as a mentor. And at first he said, oh, I shouldn't do that. And I went on to explain to him why I thought it would be really great if he did so, and that he was by now really quite removed from students, and especially undergraduates. And this would be an opportunity for him to have just an inroad into understanding what kinds of issues undergraduates were thinking about, were concerned about, and it would just be a great experience.
Stroke of genius,
him.
Yeah.
And so, as had become our pattern, he didn't say yes immediately, but I knew that if he thought about it, that he would do it. So, the next time he and I talked, and he said, well, I'm not sure I should do this, but you make some good points, so I will. And I paired him with a young woman from Washington, D.C., Sean Shears. And that was one of the most valuable relationships that any student could have. Not only did Bri serve as her mentor friend throughout her undergraduate career, but she went on to get a master's degree here. And he continued as if there hadn't been any disruption in her status here at the university at all. And that relationship continued until his death, with Bri writing to her when he was traveling abroad or sometimes bringing back a gift and making sure that he was in touch with her and that she felt comfortable in coming to talk to him about any issue at any time. So it was just what we needed.
Wow, that's great.
The other faculty and staff mentors were equally as committed to this effort as was Breck Hurl. And so there were wonderful relationships that these students cherished over the years, and that's been the case up until the present time.
Did you have any difficulty initially recruiting faculty mentors?
No, I've never had any.
Yeah. And why doesn't that surprise me?
And I'm not sure why that is the case, except that there are those who say that they can't tell me no, that I am so persuasive that they end up saying, how can I say no to this? You know, it's just the kind of thing that I ought to be doing. And I think one of the neat things about it is that the faculty enjoy these relationships perhaps more than most of them ever thought they would. And I have people who've been serving as mentors since the beginning of the program. Our current chancellor, John Wally, started the second year that the program existed, and is currently mentor to a scholar.
Oh my, as chancellor.
Yes. So the faculty know that I sort of keep check on them as well as I do with the scholars to make sure that they are getting in contact and they're interacting in meaningful ways. And by the time their first scholar is about ready to graduate, it's not unusual for a faculty member to say to me, Marcille, have I done well enough that you'll let me do this again?
Oh,
it's been a great experience. And so I have many who repeat every 4 to 5 years. When their scholar graduates, then they want to be paired again. So we've lost very few over the years.
We've talked about some of the people early on who really helped out, Joel, Corey, and Roger Howard,
right.
And of course, Breck.
Roger, I should tell you that Roger has been a mentor ever since we started the program.
Well, yeah, that
and sometimes, sometimes he's had two.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
When I would have a student sometimes that I thought needed more than he was getting in a relationship that he had, or the person might have left the university, I could always say to Roger, I'd like you to take this person on, and he'd do it.
Are there any, as I said, we've talked about some of these key people, are there any other faculty members that you would like to mention, or administrative people who have been very real supportive of the program over the years?
Oh, I'm sure there are those that I won't even remember now, but they'll come later when we're not talking about them. But Peg Geisler was in the Division of Academic Services and Outreach at the time that we were working on this program, and she certainly was another person with whom I talked a great deal about some of the ideas and, you know, how best to work them out. I think I mentioned previously that Wally Dalma was certainly very much involved because we had to also help Wally understand that whereas all of our resources were need-based at that time, that for a program of this sort, where you were trying to attract the best and the brightest, that we couldn't just focus on need, that we wanted merit, and it would be irrespective of need because of the objectives, overall objectives that we had in bringing a diverse group of very bright and talented young people to the university. Martha Taylor at UW Foundation was the foundation contact with whom I worked to get the program established in terms of fundraising. Because the foundation, up until that time, had not been raising money for scholarships and really didn't think that it would be possible to do so, nor did most other people for that matter, because there were few who thought that we could raise private funds enough to make such a program successful in those years. But we're delighted that we were able to do that, and now we're raising money here at the university for scholarships that people never thought possible. I'll just mention a couple of other people who were on that initial committee as we were selecting Marion Brown. Jim Churchill was a colleague in the same division, and certainly I've been to his ear many times also as we were trying to work this through the whole process. And we had Tom Schick, who was a professor of Afro-American studies, Omi Baldwin, a Native American who is a counselor still here at the university, and Richard Ralston was also involved in the early years. I think Richard was probably on the selection committee when we were looking for the fundraiser. And certainly the chair of the Faculty Senate Committee at that time was involved in helping us kind of work this through the system again, and that was Marion O'Leary. Truman Lowe was involved early on as well.
A very impressive list of people.
Yes, yeah. And they've all continued to be involved. We had Truman on that first selection committee. He is still on the committee, and I tell him he has to stay on it until I leave, and then he can step down. So there were, you know, a number of people who assisted in different ways along the way, and who were willing to lend their support wherever I thought I needed it.
Now, you had initially Marion at the foundation, and of course you were working here in Bascom. Did you have any staff support, staff helping you at all over the course of the years? Have you had any staff helping you, or is it pretty much?
It's, well, when we brought Marion on board, again, as I've said, this was a first for the foundation, and both Irv and Bri knew that we should move slowly in how we worked this out and how we funded the position. And so initially we had Marion as a half-time fundraiser working with the foundation and then working with me in the development of the program. It was our thought, because we had this 3-year window of approval from the administration, that we'd probably be able to have her continue in that capacity for the 3 years. And then, as Bri had suggested, then the foundation might want her to come on board full time. And we saw another opportunity there that we were really increasing, providing some diversity for the UW Foundation fundraising staff, because they had no person of color on the staff at that time. But to not so much to our surprise, the foundation within the first year was very impressed with Marion and wanted her to become full-time on their staff. And we said yes reluctantly, but we were quite pleased that that was the direction in which this was going. It was happening 2 years earlier than we had expected that it might. But we were also able to work with them to get their now full commitment to this program and the fundraising effort. Marion was very clear that regardless of whatever responsibilities that she would take on at the foundation, that the Chancellor Scholarship Program should remain a priority for her.
Okay.
And I was saying to the foundation staff that if then, you know, she joins the staff full time, at the foundation, then we want to make sure that there is this ongoing commitment to raising funds for the scholarship, and that it will not just be limited to Marion, mm-hmm. but that others mm-hmm. in the foundation would become a part of that fundraising effort as well. And maybe they didn't need to be reminded, but I never let them forget it. I don't today. And it's been great because this has been a priority and a commitment of the foundation to the present mm-hmm. time. And so as Marion's responsibilities have increased and she's been promoted to vice president there for a number of years now, there are people who work with
there are people there who have yes. responsibility for raising money for the scholarship.
And they do this as, of course, a part of their, portfolio for what they are responsible mm-hmm. for. And there is one staff member in particular, Patrick Reedy, who makes the contacts with potential donors, and he and I will make a trip to visit some donor on a monthly basis. Mm. And then there's another person on the staff, but Marion still mm-hmm. sort of oversees all of this because these staff members report directly mm. to her. And we've been very fortunate because there are other staff members at the foundation who have assisted in the fundraising. And I should mention Tim Rowley. I'm not sure I did before. Mm-hmm. I have not?
No, I don't think
Tim
so.
Was an early supporter of the scholarship, and I think certainly instrumental in helping the foundation make the kind of mm-hmm. shift that it did. And he was one of our strong fundraisers as well. As a matter of fact, he played a critical role in the largest gift we have ever received. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we've been fortunate. Mm-hmm. And now, as everybody is looking toward the foundation to raise money for the margin of excellence, mm-hmm. I'm not having to convince people that the scholarship is mm-hmm. still important. They all know mm-hmm. that. And we've been very fortunate because each chancellor and provost, vice chancellor or provost that we've had, have also been very committed to this program and have enjoyed their involvement throughout the years.
Yes, we're going to talk a little bit about the chancellors later on, because as you said, they have just played such mm-hmm. key roles for you, starting, of course, with Irv mm-hmm. Shane and our new chancellor, mm-hmm. Continuing right on to John Liley. Let's go back a little bit. You said you had six students, and you had that for 3 years, didn't you? Didn't you have like six or seven students?
The first three classes consisted of six scholars each.
Now, before we get the large increase in numbers, when you made this deal with Bri Curl and you brought Joe Corey in for that meeting, the agreement was that you would have 3 years to see whether this bird was going to fly.
Right.
At what point did it become evident to you and to Bri that this was just fine?
Well, for me, there was never a question. I always knew that it was going to be successful. And I think, I can't speak for Bri, but I would guess that, pretty early on, he felt the same way, because he was always involved in, helping to identify potential donors and talking about the program in very positive ways. So I think perhaps the initial gift that Irv mm-hmm. gave to the program gave all of us a kind of assurance mm-hmm. that, we could move forward with it. And then as Marion and I would do the fundraising, we were certainly encouraged by the kinds of responses that we received mm-hmm. from people. And, the gifts ranged all over the place. And even for those who gave smaller gifts, they were saying very positive things about our efforts, that it was really time, that the university should be doing something of this nature. And you sort of had a sense that, people were willing to make a long-term commitment to this. Mm-hmm. And that has been borne out.
That's great. After 3 years, you did increase. How many students did you have? Didn't you like triple your size or something like that?
We began to, increase the numbers, and despite the fact that I was constantly reminded by Bernie Cohen in particular, and he's another who played a very critical role in this program, that I could not bring in more scholars than I could support, and that I couldn't spend or shouldn't spend all of the money that we were raising on an annual basis, because we were developing an endowment for the program at the same time. And so he and I used to have very interesting conversations about that. And but I was always kind of able to persuade him or to maneuver in such a way that we could bring in a few more. And I'd just say to him, Bernie, this is just an incredibly outstanding group, and I can't limit it to this number. And so, you know, we'd keep kind of increasing. And I was also aware, as I'm sure all of them were, that we had to show continued improvement. You know, you start with six, and you have six for 3 years. If people are contributing, they want to know that you're moving toward what you've set as your goal. Because in that first year, we set the goal of bringing in a class of 25 new students annually and having 100 enrolled on a continuous basis and establishing an endowment of $2 million. We were moving along nicely on the other two goals. I was to be surprised with how long it would take us to raise $2 million. But if you're not investing in your endowment and you're supporting students on the money that you bring in, then that makes sense. But, you know, for somehow I kind of thought we were going to move more quickly toward the $2 million. But as the program continued and each administration saw how successful it was, they were interacting with the students, they could see what they were doing here on campus and how they were enriching the community, the leadership roles that they were taking. They began to identify some other institutional funds that could be used to support the program. For 1 year, I remember Wally had some money that he was able to provide to support an additional scholar. And then when Phil Certain was acting Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs, he identified some money that allowed us to bring in a larger number. Then I had mentioned earlier that the College of Letters and Science had a Dean's Scholarship that was also on private funds, but they weren't raising money for it. They were using a variety of funds here at the university. And when they didn't make the decision to do the fundraising, we were already doing it for this program. And the funds that were being used were those that were identified as startup funds for projects. And so they couldn't then continue to use those funds indefinitely. And so we merged then the Dean's Scholarship Program with the Chancellor's. And so that helped to increase the numbers as well. And I think that was done in 1988. And so we took on then the number of students that were in the College of Letters and Science Dean's Scholarship Program, plus the ones that we had. And so that really pushed our numbers up rather significantly. And then in the ninth or tenth year of the program, David Ward was chancellor. Now I'm skipping over some stuff, so you'll just have to remember that, you know, this is not all coming out orderly in my mind. But when David became chancellor, We were either in our ninth or going into the 10th year. I forgot. It must have been the 9th year. David came by my office, which was down the other end of the hall, one day and said, "Marcille, this program has been very successful. You've done a great job with it. And I want to do something to help you achieve the goals that you have set." And he said, "If I could make some resources available, how would you use them?" And of course he hadn't given me any amount, and so I started talking about, you know, the few things that I'd really like to do. And I said, "Well, I'd like to increase the amount of the awards because they're really not very competitive at this point." And so I said, "All right, what would you like them to be?" So I said, "Well, I'd like them to cover Wisconsin tuition and fees." And I said, "But the greater problem is with our non-residents, because we're not offering them nearly as much as peer institutions are." And so he said, "Well, what would you like?" I said, "What if we could give them fee remissions?" And he said, "Well, I think we could do that." And he said, "Well, what else?" So I said, "Well, I'd like to bring in a class of 25 scholars annually." And he said, "Well, I think we can do that."
Oh, my.
Oh, my goodness.
And I said, "And oh, David, and we really need to work on our endowment." And he said, "Now, how much do you need?" And I said, "I don't even know anymore." I said, "I know that the $2 million that we started out to raise is no longer adequate." And so he said, and he and John Wiley can work out figures in their heads more quickly than anybody I know. And so when I said to him, "Well, I want 100 enrolled on a continuous basis, and we would need an endowment to support them, and I don't know how much that would be." And he said in seconds, "Well, you'd need between 8 and 10 million. So I said, "Ooh." And then to my great surprise and great pleasure as well, he said, "I tell you what I'll do. I'll cover all of your operational expenses for the next 4 years, and all of the money you raise should go towards your endowment."
Whoa, my goodness.
I was in near shock.
My.
If I hadn't been standing up, I probably would have jumped up and screamed.
Yeah, expenses. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're back on.
And so that has been done just before the 4 years was up, I went in and said to David, "We're not going to have enough money from our endowment to support the scholars." And you gave me a window of 4 years. And he said, "Marcille, don't worry about it. As long as I'm chancellor, you will have that support. This is one of the most successful programs on this campus, and I will support it."
That's wonderful.
It is.
Well, while we're on the subject of chancellors, we've talked a lot about Chancellor Shane. If there's anything else you'd like to add about Chancellor Shane, please do it on. And also, he was followed by Chancellor Shalala, and perhaps
yes,
you could talk a little bit about her.
Thank you. I wanted to go back and talk about her as well. Donna came in, you know what her interests were with recognizing that this university existed for students. So it was very easy for her to embrace all of our efforts that were in place to make university life much more enjoyable and interesting for students, undergraduates in particular, while at the same time ensuring that they were receiving an excellent education. So again, this program was one that she heard about very quickly from people, knew of its success, and just supported it, without question. and was often heard to be referring to it as her program. Mm. And we were grateful for that as well. We perhaps I should say that the program components actually have evolved over the years. And so I've always had scholars involved to some extent in helping me think through some ideas that I had about things that we might do to make this a beneficial experience for them. So we started with, the groups were small, classes were small, and so we started with the orientation when they first arrived. And then they are seeing me on an individual basis each semester for monitoring academic progress, making sure they were taking the right courses and combination of courses, and exploring with them their career goals and aspirations, and just making sure that they were having good and valuable experiences here at the university. And people will tell you that there's no area of their lives that I refuse to talk about. I will inquire about many and all of it and share perspectives, most of which are welcomed. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they may not be, but that doesn't bother me in the least, because they know that I'm concerned about their total development mm-hmm. as individuals. And there's appreciation expressed for that time and again. And then we started having some activities for mentors and scholars. And so we had an annual picnic that we began at my house first. Mm. And I think I may have mentioned this before, that Marion and I did all of the cooking, and we'd have them there, we'd play games and eat and have great fun. And then occasionally we'd have a mentor who would say that we could have an event, a potluck, at his home. And so we did that for a while. But pretty soon, almost anything that we started in the program became a tradition. Mm-hmm. Marion is great on traditions. And so she was always reminding me, well, we did this time, we should do it again. And it's been really great, because I think one of the other reasons that this program has been as successful as it is that Marion and I work together so well, share so many of the same ideas, and have just tremendous commitment to this program mm-hmm. and what it can mean. And so we've been able to draw upon the creativity of both of us and to hammer things out and really sort of figure out what's best for these young people. And she has certainly been as involved through the early years of the program as I was in interacting with them individually. And that's why she can tell you some names that, even now, that you might consider interviewing. So that's been a key factor in the success of the program. Mm-hmm. But we've continued to add a variety of components. So in addition to the picnic, we have an annual reception in the spring, at which time we recognize our graduating seniors. And actually, that began during Shalala's administration. I had always wanted to do something like that, and we had also wanted these young people to not only meet the chancellor, but to have opportunities to interact with our chancellor. Certainly I would not have asked the chancellor to serve as a mentor, because that would seem like unfair advantage for one scholar over the mm-hmm. others. we had, I think, perhaps a couple of luncheons when Irv was here. But I wanted them to have the opportunity to go to the chancellor's residence. Mm-hmm. So we didn't quite pull that off during Irv's administration, but given Donna's great interest in being with people and entertaining at the chancellor's residence, I knew that we had a shoe in, and we did. And so we started having then, with her great enthusiasm, these receptions where we recognized our graduating seniors and just sort of talked about the program in general in terms of some highlights. So this was a time then for the mentors and the scholars to come together, and the graduating seniors would have an opportunity to talk about their experiences in the program, share what they planned to do for the future, and to make any other comments that they wanted to make. And we're still doing that. And it's one of the most inspiring experiences that I think most people have. Just to see how much these young people have grown over the years that they've been here, and to have them share that in interesting and humorous ways is really quite nice. So we've continued then to have those two annual events. And we've added other components in more recent years. One is pairing new freshmen with a continuing scholar for the first year. And we call those CS buddies. And so there too, and we again try to do these pairings, and the scholars help me do them, according to major interests, ethnicity, because we want them to become acquainted with the cultural backgrounds of all of the other students in the program, and gender considerations as well. So that's the buddy for the first year. If they want to continue beyond that, they can. We've also developed a component called Scholars Sharing Knowledge. It is not designed as a tutorial program, but rather that scholars who have done well, exceptionally well, in gateway courses in the sciences, math, economics, business, etc., would indicate their willingness to assist another scholar who may be having some initial difficulty, or who sometimes at night gets hung up on a problem or concept and can't move beyond it. Then they'll have a list of other scholars in the program whom they can contact, and they might meet with them for several times. The philosophy here is that it's sometimes intimidating to get help, first of all, for people, and especially people who are very bright. It's also that if they have difficulty understanding something and it's not understood the first time, they're not likely to ask for further clarification. But if it's a peer, they can say easily, well, you just told me this three times, but I still don't understand it. And they get the help that they need. Or they can say, tell me in words that I can understand. And, you know, feel very comfortable doing that. And so that's been an interesting aspect of their interactions with each other. And again, consistent with one of our early objectives of having them support and assist each other. So we really stress the importance of peer support networks and their being concerned about each other and, you know, reaching out in ways that are important to them. If a scholar has experienced some family or personal difficulty, if a scholar knows about it, they think, I don't know, they will share that with me so that we can then reach out to that person. And when I know things that have happened with some of the scholars, and I know that they would benefit from having some of their peers just be there for them, we keep them informed of these kinds of things so that they have the support and don't have to look for it. It's right there. And it's with people that they have a level of comfort with on an ongoing basis. Let me see, what else do we do? Oh, The university has had some resources that were provided for honors programs on campus. Mm-hmm. And this is money that comes from system through the state. And it's always been for high ability students, and so it was for the honors programs in the various schools and colleges. After learning about that a little bit more, I decided that I should make a request for some of those funds as well. Mm-hmm. And so I did. And developed the rationale that we wanted to provide some cultural enrichment experiences for these young people. And for the first year that we got resources, we took them to Chicago to see Phantom of the Opera. Hmm. And that was just a special experience for most of those young people who had never been to any kind of Broadway production mm-hmm. or major concert. And I wish you could have seen them as we walked into the theater in Chicago. I mean, their heads were all turned mm-hmm. up looking around, and they'd look at me and say, "Marcille, I've never seen anything like this before." But what I think was more important from that experience, which we've continued, is that they were introduced to an aspect of our cultural life that many people take for granted. And these young people had never been exposed to it at that level. They not only told me that many times since, because I still hear it, but some of them went back to Chicago mm-hmm. to see other productions, mm-hmm. and they took members of their families.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting.
And they will say to me, you know, time and again, "Marcille, when are we going to do this?" So we don't get enough money now that I can take them out of the city. And I don't get enough that I can take them every year because I do have another campus-wide merit-based scholarship as well called Powers NAB. And so I can't function with one group to the extent that the other one feels like they're second-class mm-hmm. citizens. So I get the money each year, but I use it alternate years, 1 year for chancellors, the next mm-hmm. year for Powers NAB. Last year, they went to see Rent. And before you leave, I'll give you a copy of our most recent newsletter.
Okay.
So that you can see what one of the scholars wrote about that experience.
I'll put that in Marcille's file in the Oral History Project office so people okay. can refer to that.
Okay. And so that's kind of the way the program has evolved over time. And despite the size of the group, I still try to see each of them individually each semester that they're here. They also know that they can come in at any time that they have problems or concerns, mm-hmm. and or if they just want to stop by to let me know how things are going. And when someone has really been struggling, I can expect to hear a knock on my door any time with somebody just saying, "I had to come and tell you. Mm-hmm. An A on my last exam," or "I got an A on my paper." And we celebrate with them mm-hmm. with these kinds of achievements. And also, of course, as we're there for them when they're struggling right. and yeah. having hard times.
So when a student comes here on this program, they inherit a family in a sense.
Yes.
They have their buddy yes. and their mentor right away. Mm-hmm. They have you mm-hmm. And this continues. And they have each other.
Yes.
Are they a strong unit as a unit, or are they pretty much just individual students who have their mentors and their classes and their other friends?
I think
Does that vary?
When in the early years, it was very easy for this to be a most cohesive group.
Mm-hmm.
And they did and shared things together. And any friends that they had also shared that kind of group cohesiveness mm-hmm. with them. As a matter of fact, I don't know if I mentioned this before, there was one a majority student who became a very close friend of two of the scholars and very quickly learned from them about the program. And so they were going to, you know, various events on campus, and these scholars would often say, well, I'm going to go talk to Marcille about this. Mm. And so they'd come to talk to me, he'd tag along, or if we were at a lecture or a concert on campus, they'd find me and we'd be talking about it afterwards. And so finally he was learning more and more about the program, and he came in one day and said to me, I want to be a part of this mm-hmm. program. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, now that's kind of interesting. And he said, well, why can't I be? And so we talked about that, and he finally said to me that it was reverse discrimination. Mm. And mm. I said, well, that's one way that I think you could look at it, and I can understand if you feel that way. But let me explain why mm. we have a program of this sort. Mm. And so I did. And he understood. So he asked me if he could participate in our activities. And I said, sure. Mm. So we invited him to the picnic, mm-hmm. to the reception, and then finally he was making appointments with me each semester, just like the scholars did. And when he graduated, he came in and said to me, Marcille, you have done more for me than anybody on this campus. You know me better hmm. than anybody on this campus. May I use you as a reference? Oh, I said, of course. So I have continued to write letters of reference. This young man developed these friendships with two of our first scholars. And as I said, I have written letters for him throughout. He stays in contact. And he said to me one day before he graduated, when I'm 21, I'm going to receive some money from my grandparents. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to make mm. a significant mm. contribution to the scholarship. Goodness. He has contributed for a number of years. Mm. And last year, when I had the surprise of their endowing a scholarship in my name, he was one of the first contributors to it.
Oh, wow. Well, you know, you hear about students who especially go to small private liberal arts colleges. One of the reasons their parents want them to go there is they want them to have the kind of experience that you are providing the students with at this big, quote, indifferent, you know, 45,000 student enrollment pop situation here.
That is very true. And that's one of the ways that I talk about the program. And during Donna's administration and since, we've really developed here at the university a number of programs and activities that provide similar experiences for many of our students. And so when I'm talking to prospective students and their parents about this program, I often say that we offer the best of both worlds, that this is an institution where they'll have access to excellent resources. It's prestigious nationally and internationally. But that we also provide the personalized experiences mm-hmm. that they would get normally on a small liberal arts campus. Mm-hmm. And when I describe the program to parents and to prospective donors as well, you know, invariably people will say to me, I wish that I could have been part of mm-hmm. a program like that. Some of our donors would say, Marcille, I understand why this program exists for these populations. I just wish so much that my son or daughter mm-hmm. could be a part of something mm-hmm. like that. Young people who work here in Bascom Hall mm-hmm. often say the same thing to me, that they know why we have it. They just wish that they could be a part of it mm-hmm. as well, because they know that these scholars always have somebody that they can go to if they're needing assistance or if they just need to talk about things. Because I think many people don't realize the kinds of issues and different experiences that university students on a campus like this have. Yeah. And they just need to have somebody that they can talk to about them, sort of bounce some ideas off and say, what do you think about this? or this is what I'm planning to do, and does it make sense? Mm-hmm. And those are the kinds of special experiences mm-hmm. that we provide for these students on an ongoing basis.
Do you ever have people come up to you and ask you how you create the sense of community? I mean, are there any other units on campus? Is anyone else experimenting with this kind of thing on campus?
And I was saying, beginning with Donna Shalala and mm-hmm. continuing through the day, through today, we have a number of initiatives that are designed now to provide the same kinds of experiences for larger groups of mm-hmm. students. Mm-hmm. For an example, you've heard of living learning communities.
Yes, right.
And our residence halls.
Are starting that. Chadbourne Residential College.
Well, even before Chadbourne,
Bradley Learning Center for
freshmen.
Yeah.
And then we have schools and colleges that are developing mm-hmm. outreach that will help to track students so that they start mm-hmm. together taking certain courses mm-hmm. and then mm-hmm. they continue to do that throughout. Across residence halls, they are also providing information to the students in the mm-hmm. residence halls about what courses different students are taking so that they can make connections. So they are study buddies, study partners, and all of that. and then a number of academic programs that have done mm-hmm. similar mm-hmm. things. Mm-hmm. So increasingly, many of our students have the opportunity to be involved mm-hmm. in experiences that are similar to this, and I think actually that much of it is also related to the success of mm-hmm. this program.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we talk about it a lot, and people will ask, how, and this is coming back to your question. At first when you ask it, I was thinking, no, people don't ask me that outright.
as a point of reference. Mm-hmm.
That they hear us talk about, they hear the scholars talk about what we do. And I never will forget, there was a retention conference on campus. Because for many years, the retention and graduation rates of students of color were just poor. And that was one of the reasons I wanted to establish the scholarship, too.
Right, okay. Much in that.
And so it's really made a very significant mm-hmm. difference to be attracting very bright and talented students. Mm-hmm. And if anybody goes back to look at our retention and graduation rates from these populations, you'll see that it's paralleling mm-hmm. the development of these two campus-wide merit programs. But I remember specifically that there was this retention conference, and they had brought in, and it was just campus, they brought in a variety of students and staff to talk about this issue and try to find out what worked and what things the campus could do differently. I was there. I didn't know that there was a scholar who had been asked to serve on a panel.
Hmm.
And within a short time, when it was her turn to talk, she said, "What has meant most to me is the fact that there was somebody here who paid attention to what was happening to me. And when I wasn't doing what I should be doing, they didn't let me get away with it."
Mm-hmm.
And she said, "Marcille will call you any hour of the night or morning. She will not let you escape." And she said, she said, "When I came here, I thought I was getting away from my mother. But I have another one." And she said, "Sometimes as much as I thought, oh no," she said, "it was those calls
mm-hmm.
from Marcille that helped me get back on track."
Mm-hmm.
And she said, when she told me one day, and she said, "Now, I was doing well academically, I want you all to understand that." And she said, "But when I went in for my appointment with her, we reviewed my academic record." And so then she said to me, "Now you know, this is good, but you're really bright and talented, and you can do better than this, and I expect you to. So I said, next semester, I want to see a GPA at about this level. Well, she said, I thought, I don't know if I can do that. She said, but sure enough, next semester, I have the GPA that Marcille told me I should have. And she said, I was so excited. And so I went in and I said to her, Marcille. She said, now, I knew she had the record, but I just had to go
tell her that
I had done it. And she said, we just hugged and shouted around in that office because I had done it. And she said, then she settled down and she said, now next semester. And that somehow I knew when they were going to class and when they weren't, even though they didn't tell me. And so she was saying, that's what many of us need.
Yeah.
That people say that we are adults and we like to think we are, but there's a big, big transition from being at home with parents, going to school every day, and coming home, and coming to a large place like this, and becoming anonymous, where nobody knows. And you just go as if it doesn't matter. She said, but there's somebody there who's saying, wait a minute.
Well, when you were first making your arguments, when we talked in our very first session about merit-based scholarships, you said one of the reasons you were interested early on is you wanted to have more role models on campus for other students.
Absolutely.
And this, I would suspect, is certainly something that has come about through this program.
Absolutely. And it was interesting because as we were developing the program, I thought it was very easy for many people around here to conceive of bringing in really bright and talented students who would serve as role models for other minority or students of color. Mm-hmm. And I never allowed anybody to limit it to these students becoming role models for each other. I'd always say, and all students in general. And that is precisely what has happened. I can go places and people will recognize my name. And that's because they know Chancellor Scholars. Mm-hmm. And they'll say, you know, when I say my name is, oh, you're Marcille. I've been wanting to meet you. I've been wanting to talk to you. But how do they know me?
Yeah.
Well, they know me from hearing the scholars talk
about
me.
They know of you,
yes.
Right.
And they will tell me with great delight that they know Chancellor Scholars. Hmm. And they'll talk about how they've helped them. Mm-hmm. Now, in our monthly meetings, and I haven't talked about those either, we have, in terms of program components, all of the scholars meet together on a monthly basis, and that's what Jim was just asking about. We have a meeting on Sunday.
Oh, I see,
Chancellor Scholars meet the first Sunday of each month, and for an hour and a half. And in the first 30 minutes of that meeting, we're providing information to them on an ongoing basis on opportunities and resources that are available to them here at the university and elsewhere. I'll have a literature table, and people are always sending me stuff. There's information that I gather, and I collect, and I take it there. And it sometimes is information on scholarships that they can apply for. Or it may be some unit on campus that wants students to participate in something. So it's just a wide variety of information. And then we talk about housekeeping things. There are things that I may want to bring to their attention that I've observed that many need to be reminded of. And then we have a mixer. This is, again, to make sure that they're feeling comfortable in the group, they're getting acquainted with each other, and they can relax. Mm-hmm. As one of the things I think I didn't anticipate was how really bright youngsters can be intimidated easily by each other. each one seems to feel, or many of them seem to feel, that everybody else is brighter than they are. Mm-hmm. And so...
Been there, done, thought that.
But I didn't anticipate that for some reason, yeah. And it sort of hit me by surprise. And I realized it in the next part of what we do in that hour and a half, and that is we have what we call fireside chats. Mm. Never a fireplace, but it's the...
lots of chats.
It's the atmosphere and the ambience that I want to create for these. And so we invite in top faculty and staff from around the campus to talk about contemporary issues or innovative research that they're doing. And so here again, the scholars have access to many faculty and staff that they might not otherwise get the opportunity to know. But they're talking about issues not specifically relating to their majors, but rather contemporary issues, issues that emerge here on campus, and research that some of them are doing. And then the scholars engage in informal discussion with them. Chancellor Ward, and I'm sure John will continue this.
Chancellor Wiley, yes.
Said to me that I invited him to come and talk once. He enjoyed it immensely, and he did it every year.
Wow.
I'd see him in the summer, and he'd say to me, Marcille, when am I coming to speak to the scholars? They enjoyed him, because he talked to them about the university and how it functions. He talked to them about his vision for this institution. He talked to them about what's happening in higher ed in general and what he sees as trends for the future. And he would always say to them that he enjoyed talking to them more than he did any other group on this campus, including faculty.
Interesting.
Because, he said, they asked more interesting questions, and it was an opportunity not only for him to hear from students about what they thought about certain issues, but also to learn with them as they were learning from him. So it was a very special bond there. He always attended every annual reception, and would have remarks at those as well. Now, as the group grew larger, developing that kind of cohesiveness became a greater challenge. And so, because I have the two programs, I often used Powers Nap that I don't do quite as much with because I don't have to raise the money, as sort of my palette for testing things and seeing how they work. So that program is larger than Chancellor's and a bit more unwieldy in terms of my ability to get to know them and to interact with them as effectively. And so I decided to organize them by classes. And each class has co-chairs, so it can be two to three, who either volunteer or are selected by that class for the leadership of the group. And they will meet at least twice a semester, and each class plans a social and a service activity for members of the class. So a smaller group, interacting more freely, planning activities together, and we do expect all of the scholars to give back to the community. So they hear regularly from me that I expect them to give back to the community as individuals and also as members of the group. we have had, in the last 3-4 years, program projects. We first collected Campbell soup labels to assist Bacon College in Muskogee, Oklahoma, in purchasing a van for student use. We collected thousands and sent them to them. They got their van last May. And I don't think the scholars want to hear much about any more soup labels. We're beginning this year to collect and this is both programs, tabs from soda or pop cans for the Ronald McDonald House. Hmm. And we will come together for some kind of ethnic event and collect and present our collection of tabs to the Ronald McDonald House. I think it's extremely important for young people to understand that they should be giving back to help other people. And this has been an emphasis of the program from the beginning.
Yeah, that's really important.
Because I remind them that others are giving so that they can have these special experiences here. It's helping them become better stewards of their talents and abilities and their resources as they get them. One of the things that's real encouraging to me is not only to hear from the scholars that when I make some money, I'm going to give it back to the scholarship, but to see on my donor lists as they come from the foundation that frequently there are scholars who are in graduate school or professional school sending in a contribution to the scholarship. There are those who tell me that they know that I've been struggling to build up the endowment, but that I shouldn't worry about it, because they will ensure that this scholarship continues because of the experiences that they had. And so there are several out there now who are planning to endow scholarships.
Wow.
Luis Marrero is one of them. And he's thinking now that he may be able to do more than one.
Oh, why?
He asked me several years ago what was the largest gift that I had received for the scholarship thus far. And when I told him, he said, "I will top."
You should have jacked it up to 10,000.
Well, he'll do it. But now he's not, as I said, he's not talking about endowing one, which
That's
is
amazing.
At about the $100,000 range. Whoa. He's talking about five.
Oh my goodness.
And I have others who are planning to do it in honor of a parent. And
sure.
Some have said to me, "Well, Marcille, we were going to endow one in your honor, but that's already been done. But we'll continue to contribute to the scholarship."
Now, wasn't your endowment a surprise to you? Talk about that for a moment. I think you might have been pretty much knocked speechless for a little bit, as I recall hearing from some other people.
That's putting it mildly.
Now, was this at the 15th anniversary?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Why don't you talk about that for a minute? It's a real warm moment in the history of the program, I think.
One of many. We've celebrated two anniversaries, the 10th and the 15th. Mm-hmm. Our plan, or my thoughts were, let me just say, that we would probably do this every 10th year.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But when we had the 10th, many of the scholars, both current and former, said to me, "Marcille, 10 years is too long.
Mm-hmm.
You need to have it at shorter intervals so
You're
that
right.
we can come back when we know people still in the program and still on campus."
Mm-hmm.
So I talked to Chancellor Ward and said, "You know, we'd like to do this maybe in increments of 5 years." So he said, "Okay," and I gave him the reason. He said, "Okay, that makes sense."
Mm-hmm.
So, fine. So as we were planning, the 15th anniversary, Marion, one of her assistants at the foundation, and I were spending, you know, a good deal of time trying to work all of this through and make sure that it would be the quality of event that we wanted. And I never will forget, and this was only in retrospect that I was able to make this connection, when we were talking about people to invite to the reception. So we'd made a decision that we would invite people who had contributed at a certain level and above.
Mm-hmm.
So as her assistant gave me the list of people that were going to be invited that met that criteria, I saw some names on there, since I see all of the donor lists, that I knew had not contributed at that level. And so I'm looking at this list and I said, well, why is this person here? They haven't contributed that amount of money. Why is this person here? And Marion said, without a moment's hesitation, oh, perhaps they contributed and you haven't gotten that ledger yet. Hmm. Well, that was reasonable. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that, okay. And then one other time, I saw something, Mercile J. Lee, Chancellor Scholarship. So I said, what is this? And so she said, what? And I showed it to her, and she said, oh, that's a mistake. I don't know how that got in there. No, we'll take care of that. Don't worry about it. So I said, fine. I hadn't a clue. And my colleagues and friends and scholars all believe that I know everything. And Chancellor Ward has contributed to that, because he would say to the scholars on one occasion after another, Mercile knows everything. Don't think she doesn't know it just because she doesn't say anything to you about it. She knows. She knows more about what's going on around here than anybody that I know. And he went so far on one occasion to say to them, she's like God. She knows so long about, oh my goodness. And so there was this great interest on the part of everybody involved with this to keep it from me. They wanted to do something that I did not know. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard for people to keep things from me. It's not that they tell me, but I pick up on clues.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And nothing. So that night, I mean, we had gone through what we were going to do and, you know, looked at every detail. And so I had the closing remarks for that night. And so I gave an update on the program, thanked all of the donors, you know, said all of the wonderful things about the scholars and our donors. And we had a reception thereafter. And so as I was leaving the stage, the young woman who had served as the MC mm-hmm. for the evening walked up and said, Mercile, you can't leave the stage yet. And I said, but we're done. And so she said, no, you can't leave. Well, then here came another scholar with these gorgeous red roses. So I thought, oh, I wish they wouldn't do this. But at any rate, I had to go back. And then as she walked up, Irv Shane walked up on the platform as well. So the scholar presented the roses. And it was a rose for every year of the program.
Oh,
and she did a beautiful job in her comments. And so just as I was getting ready to respond to that, Irv said he wanted to say something. So he walked up and announced the establishment of the Mercile J. Lee Chancellor Scholarship and said that they wanted to do this because of the great work that I had done in establishing this program and making it so successful, but that they got more pleasure out of doing it and keeping it from me than they did in actually doing it. And I was just speechless. I hadn't a clue. Nothing.
And they knew it, and I bet they loved
they
it.
They knew it. They all enjoyed it. And, you know, I saw people there who had come from out of town. But I didn't think anything of that because it was homecoming weekend. So, see, we had planned it homecoming weekend. Well, that was also a part of Marion's strategy as we were talking about when best to have it. And so she said, well, I think, you know, we ought to have it during homecoming weekend. And I said, that would be great, but there's so much going on, you know, at that time. And so she was saying, but yeah, but you know, some of the scholars could come back for more mm-hmm. than one event. Mm-hmm. And so I said, yeah, that's true, so let's try it. Well, all of that was a part of the strategy so that they could have more people come. And two, I would never get suspicious when I saw other people there who were from out of town. How they could have kept something secret, and this is more than 300 people knowing for more than 2 years.
Oh my goodness,
is beyond me.
That is amazing.
But when I saw copies of the letters that went out under Irv's and Bernie's name, and also the ones that went from Marion and others who were on this committee, she pulled together a committee of great friends and colleagues. And they worked to do it, and nobody ever said a word. Mm. But people told me afterwards, we couldn't say anything, Marcille, on fear of our lives. Mm-hmm. That in every letter that they received, it said, you must not tell Marcille, because if you do, she won't let us do it. Mm. And that message was on every correspondence that they sent out. So everybody in the room knew it, except me.
That must have just been an amazing moment.
It was.
Yeah.
And I was truly speechless. And I said that the scholars wouldn't believe it, but it was true. I didn't know what to say. But then I talked, and I never remembered a word I said afterwards. Not a word. And I worried about it. And I thought, what did I say? Did I come off like a bumbling idiot or what? And people came up to me at the reception and said, you knew. And I said, no, I didn't. And they said, yes, you did. And I said, honestly, I did not know. And they were saying, well, how could you talk like that? You had a prepared speech. And I said, I didn't. I don't know what I said. So what did I say? And I called Richard Ralston after that, and I said, Richard, what did I say? Did I?
Richard Ralston said you did not embarrass yourself and your friends, and no,
he
it
said
was excellent.
It was excellent. And people continue to talk to me about what I said that night. Mm. And none of it connected for me at all. Never has.
Oh my goodness.
It was just that I talked. My family knew as well. And when I got home that night, the phone rang, and it was my son. And he said, congratulations, Mom. Did you cry? And I said, no. You knew about this? Oh, yes. I thought, oh my, I said, how long have you known? He said, ever since they started planning.
Uh-huh.
And he said, everybody in the family knew. I mean, it was just.
So everybody in your universe knew,
yes.
Except you.
Yes, I was the only person who didn't know.
That's amazing.
And then, you know, scholars said to me afterwards, Marcille, I couldn't even call and talk to you because I was afraid. And I didn't let slip. And they said, you know how you are on picking up clues. I just couldn't talk to you because I was afraid that I would say something and give it away. So, well, you didn't. It was truly one of the most memorable moments of my life.
Even though you can't remember what you said.
No.
Yeah.
It was just overwhelming.
That was great. Yeah, I've talked to Irv Shane about that night, and he said it was really a very special night. And when you think back to, you know, 16 years earlier, Bri Curl going into his office and saying, hey, I got this person on my staff, and she has this kind of crazy idea, and what do you think? It's really quite a story.
It was one of the most heartwarming occasions, because it was like all of the family was there. Everybody who'd been associated, of course everybody wasn't there. But it was just such, the scholars talk about it now as, you know, just so special and full of expectation because they knew what was going to happen and that the warmth and good feelings that were there, they had never experienced mm-hmm. before. And they all, of course, enjoy the fact that I was surprised. So now they know that I don't know everything.
I have just one more question I want to ask. One thing we haven't talked about, and that's the future of the program. What kind of goals are you setting? What do you see as the future of the program at this point in time?
Well, I think from an institutional perspective that, you know, obviously we'll want to increase the size of the program. Mm-hmm. John Wally, as well as David Ward, have continually indicated that they wanted to see it increased. Mm-hmm. John would like it to increase yesterday. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But one of the challenges that we'll have with this is certainly continued fundraising, and I'm just delighted with what we've been able to do to this point. We're not at our 10 million, but we have about 8 million in the endowment. But that's inadequate because mm-hmm. tuition or educational mm-hmm. costs it's getting continue more expensive, right? to increase every year. And we're not competitive with our peer institutions because most of them offer more. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They're offering full scholarships, whereas we're offering a scholarship that covers tuition. And our non-resident costs escalate even more rapidly mm-hmm. than resident. And we will face continual challenges there in terms of maintaining some geographic diversity mm-hmm. in the program. And the university will have to hire more staff. Mm-hmm. I've done this over all these years primarily alone with administrative assistance, clerical assistance mm-hmm. is what mm-hmm. it is. And it results in my working extremely long hours. And certainly, you know, if a person doesn't have the passion for the program that I have, they're not going to work mm-hmm. those kind of hours and shouldn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, nobody should have to work those kind of hours. But I do it because of my passion for what this is all about and helping these young people chart their way through this university in preparation for their lives thereafter. And whether or not the staff is going to be available to do it is another question. So we'll have to work with that.
Well, the winds are fairly favorable. I remember last time we talked, we were wondering who the new chancellor was going to be. Didn't they have a list of three people? And
yes.
We were saying, geez, I wonder if they're going to go internal or external. And that question has certainly been answered. And I would say that that would bode well for the program. You have one of the almost original people.
Yes. Supporters.
Supporters. Yeah. He's been in this program since, what did you say, the second year or something
yes.
like that?
Yes. So. And I think that does bode well for it. But, you know, this university has always been lean on the staff side.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it has.
And when you have something that's working and is successful with limited staff, it'll take a stretch to, mm. you know, mm. conceive of how many others you need to involve. And it's been one of those things that all of us have been aware of. I can't tell you how many times David Ward or John Wally has said to me, Marcille, we need to get you some help. So we all acknowledge it, but we just haven't mm-hmm. taken that next step.
Well, maybe that is the next step. Yes.
Oh, it yeah. is absolutely yeah. the next step. And I suppose, you know, that we may need to take a look at the two programs that we have and see whether or not we want to continue them as separate programs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They have similar but different objectives. They have similar program components because I'm administering both of them. But it's a labor-intensive process, to say the least.
Yeah.
And, you know, to keep the program going, to stay in touch with donors, and, as they say, continue the cultivation of your donors so that they will continue to support the program also takes time.
Yes, it does.
Yeah. And then we have a newsletter. And, you know, I could have somebody doing the newsletter easily, but it has to be somebody who's intimately involved with the program and having the ongoing contacts with both former and current scholars in order to do that. So it's grown in lots of neat and interesting ways, but it's labor-intensive, and we've got to take a good and careful look at that.
Well, thank you so much for three very interesting sessions. As you know, I plan on interviewing some other people who have been involved in this program, and I'm more enthusiastic now than ever. It's a very, very important thing that you've been associated with over the years, and I'm really thankful that I can do my little bit in trying to get the history down for future people to, for people in the future to listen to. So, I think, anything else, any closing comments?
Well, I guess I should thank you, even though I really didn't want to do this. But as John Wally has reminded me over time, at least we get something down. And we don't know when I'm going to write the history, but one of these days I'll do it. And this record is certainly going to be an important one. And,
well, what?
And I can say that I appreciate having the opportunity to do it, perhaps more than doing it, because it has refreshed my memory, and I will jot down some things that certainly should be included in the history as a result of this experience.
Well, I guarantee you that the interviews I will do this year and the next year or two are going to be very helpful to you when you do write the history, because we'll get those very key people down and get their thoughts down. So, again,
wonderful.
Thank you very much, and
well, thank you.
The interview is now over.